because the Eva Cohen, who has been welfare director of the union, was pregnant and probably wouldn't be able to return for many months, if at all. He offered me this rather reluctantly because he thought that it would not be the kind of job I would like to take. But since I was in desperate need of work,
why wouldn't he?
Well, he felt that being a welfare director was too oriented towards individuals, and that I had been something of a public person, that I had dealt with large groups and so on, but perhaps it would be too small a job. On the other hand, he knew that I would not be interested in an organizer's job because that was too tiring and grueling. So he offered me this, but he wasn't sure that I would accept. However, I asked him to write me a note and tell me when he would like me to come. And on November 26, 1941, he informed me that the position would be open at the end of the year, and if I was still interested, I should get in touch with him, which I did. And beginning December 10th or thereabouts, 1941, just about at the time of the Pearl Harbor disaster, I became the welfare director of Local 6. I threw myself into this work because, in a sense, it was similar to what I had done as a social worker, and I wanted to get to know the individual members of the union, and the way in which I could establish a base or a constituency for myself was through what I could do for them as individuals. And they were very appreciative because we did some remarkable things for these people. In the first place, there was a general union-wide educational plan for help the workers on the job when they were injured. They knew very little about the workman's compensation law, and this was a form of educating them as to their rights under the law, which they appreciated. We also helped them in many of their personal problems, and from time to time I would go to the hotels, or the shops as they were called, and discuss with individual members or with the shop stewards some of the individual problems that the workers had, were never discussed except through the welfare department of the union. The organization of the hotel and club workers was excellent. There were departments in every hotel. And each department had a chairman, a shop chairman. And each shop chairman was instructed as to his duties. And most of these shop chairmen were very conscientious people who had worked in the union before. So that the organization was rather well, tightly knit, and well planned. And it flourished. The variety of workers in the hotel and club union spanned the whole gamut of employment. Everything from housemaids to bartenders to simple porters, maintenance workers to waiters, waitresses. The union had many women workers. Many of whom had never had any background in unionism at all, and it was a challenge to be able to work with them.
Now, as the welfare director, did you have anything? You saw the people in the union and took care of the welfare problems. Did you have anything to do, for example, with getting more welfare issues into the contract? Or was it just the individual workers that you saw? Did you help the union policy toward welfare also?
Well, there really wasn't very much to do in that regard. The union supported the workmen's compensation activity by hiring an attorney who would go with the workers to trials when there were injuries on the job. The other problems related to filing income taxes, to personal problems in the home where where it was necessary to refer to other agencies, daycare and so on. There was little daycare, very little in the city.
So would your union get anxious in fighting for daycare? That's what I mean.
No.
If it was on another level?
They were strictly involved in union activities, mm-hmm. but it was broader than just the old AFL type of union. This is an industrial union mm-hmm. organized during the period of the CIO organizing drive, but it was in a craft union setup.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the skilled workers still identified themselves as separate and apart from the unskilled and the semi-skilled workers in the hotels. So there was a great deal of education to be done on the union level.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the union, when union contracts were up for discussion, there would be many months of preparation for this. And a great deal of the time of the organizers and the union officials were given to the strategy and tactics involved with the employers, so that the personal problems of the union, of the members was left largely to the welfare department, and it was an innovation for a union to have such a department, because normally the unions in the city gave very little attention to the personal problems of the workers.
Really?
But
mm-hmm.
it was Obermeier's idea, and mm-hmm. Obermeier had a very distinct feeling that one could not overlook the personal problems of workers, because it brought the workers closer to the union.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very cooperative, and whenever I needed money for publications or for posters or for any kind of educational material, he was very ready to furnish that. In fact, he gave me a great deal of help and cooperation on many problems. And I was deeply devoted to him and to the organizers of the union as a whole, because they all represented young people who had come, many of them had come out of school, colleges, had given up their college work to become union organizers, because this was in the air, this was the spirit of the times, was to build unions for the workers, and many of them were very intelligent people. I'd like to mention one or two of mm-hmm. of my co-workers, organizers. There was Charles Collins, who was a black man, who had various jobs before he became a union organizer. He was an actor. He was a waiter. He did many things because, as an intelligent black man, he could find very little work. He was an organizer and was extremely influential with the black workers in the air. With bringing more black workers into a union, and with helping them to understand what the union was all about. Then there was Don Tillman, who was a young Columbia college dropout, who had worked with the union during the days of the strikes in the late 30s, and had helped to establish the organization. He was clever. He was warm, and was very much loved by the workers. Then there was Tony Lopez, who was a Spaniard, who had a fine appeal to the Puerto Rican workers. There were many many people on the organizing.
Were there women who appeal to the women workers?
There were many. Yes, there were many people on the staff that were brought in to appeal to certain minorities mm-hmm. within the union, and among them were several women. There were two or three women who one was an organizer for the housekeeping department, and she was an Irish woman who had great charm and was very influential among the maids. I have forgotten her name, but she was mm-hmm. quite an influence. And then there was Nick Harris, who was Greek, who was a charming personality, a very educated, intelligent man who couldn't find work but became an organizer with us. And there were others of this sort.
There was still massive unemployment.
There was. But in organizing the hotels, we were, in a sense, able to establish an employment office so that we could send people to jobs when we knew there were vacancies. And the shop stewards, of course, would inform us whenever they were, so that a union man could get into the shop. The whole setup was, I must say, a tribute to the earlier work of all of these dedicated people who had built the organization. And we were very proud of the hotel workers. They were the largest local union in the city, or among the largest in the city, and were quite influential. But the union as a whole was known to be a progressive union made up of progressives. I would also want to mention my very close co-worker, Senator Dowd, who was the editor of the union paper, who cooperated with me in every way in pushing my activities and in...
The Gallen thing?
No.
No.
Had
he worked on the Sacramento Gazette?
He may have. Mm. I didn't know him in the late 20s, but I did know him in the early 30s because I met him in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And he was then on the Moscow... he was then the Daily Worker correspondent in Moscow. And then I met him over and over again in the past, and we have been lifelong friends. We're still very good friends. All of these people were very close to me, and their cooperation was always ready. And I think that those first 2 years in the union were very useful.
How long did you work there?
For 9 years.
For 9 years? Oh, wow.
Until I entered...
You were welfare director?
I'm going on.
Okay.
As time went on, the work became very, very much enlarged. More workers were coming to the welfare department, and as a result, after consultation with the executive board of the union, a person was placed in charge of the welfare work so that I would not have to deal with the individual workers on their case problems, but I would be released for educational work. In the meantime, the war had started. There were many problems in regard to the war that the union, in line with the general feeling among anti-fascists and progressives, was that we must do everything to help the war effort. And I became War Services and Educational Director. Roughly, this happened about 1943. The welfare director who was appointed was directly under my supervision and guidance. Her name was Grace Neal. Now, let's...
Starting again
now. Your activities in the union started almost at the beginning of the war. And since there were already many of our union members who were being recruited for the army, and there was a great deal of interest among the union memberships for pursuing war activities, there were, however, others who were reluctant to do anything for the war. There were many who, such as the Irish members who were not altogether 100% behind the
war. Was there prejudice challenge to German members?
I think it was anti-British feeling more than anything else. And many of the people were strongly... They had just come over from Ireland and gotten into work in here, you see. So that one had to overcome certain of the anti-war feeling that existed. But generally, I must say that during the first year, the impact of the war had very little effect on the members. There was constant movement to the defense industries and better paid jobs, and this created difficulties in the shops because there was so much movement. In my report, I say that there was a growing consciousness of the significance and meaning of the war among a larger number all the time. And by the time we were in full swing with our activities, most of the members in the union had friends, relatives, or neighbors who had already been inducted into the service, and there was great concern about
Did you see any change in the membership of more pro-Russian because they were all allies?
Well, at first, I think that the feeling was not very strongly pro. It was not very strongly for the war itself, and then later, as the Russians took on the brunt of the fighting, there was recognition that that American boys were being saved by Russian sacrifices, and this gave us an entree to explaining the whole situation in regard to the war. And we found that the prejudices were strong against Russia, but as time went on, one could talk about the participation of the Soviet Union without any feeling that we were alienating anybody. I can't say that there was a great support until later on in the war for the Soviet Union. Many of the members felt, let them bear the brunt, and then we'll be able to save our own skins.
What about anti-fascism?
Well, there was always a core within the union that was anti-fascist. It was part of the original organizing
forces.
But among the workers, the anti-fascist feeling was not very strong. They really didn't understand the politics of the war at all.
This was
a problem that I encountered and that I had to overcome. And in all my educational work, I went from hotel to hotel, from club to club, explaining to the workers during their working hours, the employer permitted us to have meetings because of the war, and it was possible for me then to explain the basic political questions involved in the war and the role of the Soviet Union. Many knew that I was pro-Soviet, and some tolerated it. Nobody really was opposed to what I was saying, but some were indifferent.
Now, let me ask you, did more women workers come into the union? Did you do special things for women workers?
Well,
fight for equal pay, set up daycare,
yes.
Shopping, transportation, laundry, anything to make it easier?
There was a large influx of women. But the problems of equal pay, except in the case of the waiters and waitresses, were not so great. Women were predominantly in the housekeeping department. They did not do...
Segregation.
Yeah. There was a separation of the sexes in the sense that the heavy porter's work was done by men.
But it was better paid.
No, it wasn't.
Mm.
They were all low-paid jobs. They were considered unskilled workers. And with the need for more workers as men and women both were being recruited into the war, into war industries, there was a substantial influx of black women who were completely untrained and had to be shown all of the ways of doing things in the hotel, and although the work was unskilled, nevertheless it required some direction. These women, most of them, were not even aware of unionism. They had been hard-working domestic workers for the most part, and coming into a almost factory setup, there were many things for them to learn and. It took quite some time, but as the war went on, they became the most devoted members of the union and participated in all the activities with great enthusiasm.
Is there lots of turnover?
Not in certain departments,
uh-huh.
But in other departments there were. For example, many of the young waiters and bartenders were inducted into the service. That meant more women waitresses. The bartenders would not permit women.
Did your union fight them?
We fought it, and we were opposed to that attitude, but we couldn't break it down because the bartenders who remained in the service were older men who said that this was no place for a woman to work. It was too rough. They very often had to work in the hotels until way after midnight. And there was a general anti-woman feeling in the bar department. We tried to break it down, but we found that it wasn't a priority as far as the union was concerned. There were other things that were more important. So very little was accomplished as far as the bar was concerned. Here and there would be a bar girl who would be employed, but it was against the wishes of the bartender's department. You see, each section of the hotel was divided into a department, and there was a complete union in each department, and they had a great deal to say about the hiring of workers and the firing of workers and the admission of new members to their group. The bartenders, of course, were the most highly skilled and the most highly paid of all of the hotel workers. The problems of equal pay arose in the case of the waiters and waitresses, and there it was clear that the women and men would both get the same rate of pay. But the rate of pay was so small, they depended largely on tips, so that the issue was not very very seriously challenged. The women were interested in making big tips, and that was really their source of income.
The other question I have is, in light of what happened after,
yeah,
to the union, do you think that the union did anything wrong during that war period?
No, I think that, as a matter of fact, I think that their relations to the AFL-CIO were strengthened during the war period, because the national body was always proud to be able to say that the union had raised funds for war bonds, that the union had participated in various other activities. They weren't happy about what we did for Russian war relief, but they were happy about the fact that we would support the Red Cross and other
agencies. Did overtime pay? Overtime? Did workers work a lot of overtime? Because I know a lot of workers worked overtime during the war. Didn't more than
now
eat out?
Yes.
Travel around and go to hotels?
Yes, there was a great deal of... The hotels were very busy, but I am not clear about overtime, because there were shifts. There had to be shifts because many of the hotels were open until way after midnight. There was a special department known as the banquet department that served dinners and large parties after the normal hours. And they had a special wage for that work. Now, whether they took into consideration the fact that the hours were very late, I'm not sure. I don't remember that very well.
You don't think that your union at all let the workers down, and therefore, or didn't educate them, so therefore, when the purges came, the workers didn't support those people?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the workers supported all of our organizers right to the very end, and that the purge came as a result of directives from the AFL-CIO national body, which was very reactionary. It was headed by a man by the name of Hugo Ernst, who himself was at one time a social democrat, and they were ordered to fire these people. They didn't do it of their own will, and they probably never would have done it if it hadn't been for the fact that they wanted to save, in their opinion, they were saving the union by conforming to the wishes of the national body. But in actuality, many of the top officials had already turned away from the progressive movement and thought of their official jobs as careers for themselves.
But how had this come about?
Well, this is a process which I'll explain as we go along, because it was an evolutionary process.
I think that's really important.
Yeah, as they became more successful as union officials and had great prestige in the labor community, they became more possessive of the union and of their right to run the union, and they were fearful of any methods that might attempt to destroy the organization. And in the end, they capitulated completely to the reactionary leadership of the AFL-CIO. They did not have the courage, nor did they have the convictions, let's say, of the officials of the UE, who would not conform and therefore became independent unions. They did not have the courage to do that. And in some respects, they were dealing with employers who were who had for years resisted unionism and who were not ready even now to accept the union.
Did you see this capitulation happening slowly
as they got closer to the White House? The capitulation started, I think, with the after the war, when there was the great hysteria against the Reds, and most of the leading officials of both the union and the central body of the union, which incorporated other local unions besides ours, were in some way or another related to previous activities in the communist movement or in the anti-fascist movement. And these men were the ones who were frightened about the future of their jobs and the future of the union itself, and were not very courageous. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
During this period, committees were established in each shop for war activities. And the chairman of these committees would carry out the general program of the executive board of the union, which was under my direction. There was a great deal of activity relating to blood donations, the welfare of our soldiers, war relief, civilian defense, and these were fully reported to the executive board of the union. And there was a special military service committee set up for taking care of the soldiers that were inducted into the service from our union. Gifts for servicemen were organized.
Mm-hmm.
And
did the servicemen, could they get their jobs back when they came back?
Yes, the jobs were held for the men, and many of them returned to their former jobs when the war was over.
Taking women out.
What?
They displaced women?
Sometimes it was understood when a person would take a job of a serviceman that he, and there were no other jobs available, that he would have to he'd have to give it up. But we didn't really have too much displacement. We were able to find jobs for all the people who came back.
What about protective legislation during the war?
I don't really...
Safety things to be comfortable.
Well,
fluids that were used.
Yeah, we were continuing our work. The general union work was continued.
Mm-hmm.
The war activities did not displace the general concern for the rights of labor, for the enforcement of the contracts, and for the general activities of a shop committee. There was a great deal of participation by the membership. This was one of the remarkable things about this union, that we were able to involve so many of these workers who had never been in a union before.
So you didn't let standards go for the war effort?
No. I wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
Charlotte is just looking through her papers from this
period. Yes. And this was 1943, when the war spirit of Local 6, dominant and dry, was one of my articles. I wrote regularly for the Hotel and Club Voice, which was the official organ of the membership. And one of my reports showed that 60% of the members contributed to war aid during that period, which was a good percentage, you know, more than half.
Yeah.
Of course, we were in the forefront of the unions in the city, in our war chest drives, and showing war movies and inculcating a union war spirit so that the workers would feel that they were helping to win the war.
And this was a full-time job, 9 to 5 and more?
And later. And for many years, I would not arrive at home until after 8 o'clock because of the late meetings that we had. And very often, I wouldn't come home until way after midnight, which brought the remark from my daughter that I was only a weekend mother.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have weekend work.
I did, but I tried not to. And I tried to spend as much time with her as I could. My husband was really the strong father-mother in this situation. His office is close to our apartment, and he would come home during the day when Mira was returning from school, and would be with her until dinner time. But one of my daughter's complaints was that he never would permit us to serve dinner without my presence. So often we didn't have dinner until 8:30 or 9 o'clock at the evening.
Would he cook the dinner when he came home?
Well,
when he came home,
a development occurred which facilitated my activities. My mother left my father, who went into a nursing home, and came to live with me. And this was just about the time when I entered the Hotel and Club Employees Union. She was very vigorous, very active. She did all the shopping for the household, all the cooking. Mm-hmm. And she was always there when Mira arrived from school, so that there was never a problem of worry on my part. My mother did relieve me tremendously from all the burdens of household concerns.
And Mira liked her.
And Mira loved her very dearly. And, of course, my mother was an excellent cook, and she showed Mira many ways of cooking. And Mira was very absorbed in learning how to cook and to sew and to do things that other children were doing in the school, on top of her interest, of course, in her studies. And her father was a great stimulus to her in that regard. But she saw very little of me. I must say that our relations were not close during those early years. Later, as she grew older and was able to travel by herself on subways and buses, she would come to the union office and after school and spend a little time with me at the office. She often attended my lectures. She said I talked very loudly. And I agreed that perhaps in my desire to convince my audience, I may have been a little noisy. But she was quite critical of me. But she enjoyed coming, and she especially enjoyed my taking her to some of the restaurants in the area, which were very good. She enjoyed having the experience of eating out in a restaurant. She often brought her schoolmates to the union to see me and to hear my discussion.
So she was proud, too.
She was very proud, but on the other hand, she was a little resentful of my not being with her too much. On the other hand, I think that as time went on, she felt that she had been given more independence than most children, and therefore she had something to be grateful for. We always, both my husband and I, carried her along with us, with our activities. We discussed everything at home. She asked questions, and she knew what we were doing. And I recall one interesting incident that she reported to us. When her teachers in school asked her what types of publications her parents read, she related some of the weeklies such as the New Republic and the Nation, and then she said, and some other journals that I'm not permitted to talk about.
Oh.
Which we thought was rather rather naive and sweet.
But the school was progressive too, right?
The school was progressive, but not altogether as far out as we were.
Uh-huh.
In other words, from time to time, they would call us in and say that they thought that the indoctrination Mira was getting was a little too much, that she was out of touch with her own peers.
Mm-hmm.
And that we ought to try to control that if we could, because she would be isolated, and she would not have the kind of experience that she should have with the children, mm-hmm. With the other children. But we were not able to change our lifestyle, and while we knew that in a way she might have to pay a penalty for it, on the other hand, she was so completely confident and proud of what we were doing that carried her along through those years. I must say that she had difficulties with other children, that she wasn't one of the most popular kids in the class, although she was one of the brightest. She was always chosen for work in higher mathematics, for example, and so on. But she was not tremendously popular.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was with left wing things.
This was attributed to the fact that she was somewhat dogmatic when she would make statements in class.
Mm-hmm.
And she was dogmatic because she felt she had the power, influence, and support of her parents. We were troubled by this, but we could not see how we could change our lifestyle.
Right. I'm going to